Hello, welcome to the Gentle Rebel podcast. I'm Andy Mort, sound artist, songwriter and slow coach, and I love exploring the potential that is wrapped up in the depths of our sensitivity through creativity, play and human connection. In this episode, I want to share a conversation that I had at the end of 2023. In the Haven Courtyard, when I invited Roxana Alexandru and Neil Hughes to talk with me about, I guess, using humour to befriend the inner critic and address social anxiety. It was a topic that I was, I'd been thinking about exploring for a long time, because I think humour is such an important part of the toolkit that we have as human beings. It's something that I think is missing in a lot of areas of life. When we talk about high sensitivity, we talk about the senses, obviously the five senses, but I think the sense of humour as well is such an undervalued kind of member of that family of senses, and it can help in so many ways. And so I've been following, what Rox and Neil have been doing over the years. Both of them have been shining examples of the way that humour can be used to change the relationship that we have with ourselves, with those parts of ourselves that we want to shift and work on. And so, I thought this was a conversation worth sharing outside of the Haven as well, and on the podcast, because it really speaks to something that I know a lot of people have experience with and deal with. And I just really loved the way that Rox and Neil opened up this topic and the direction that the discussion took as we went through. I do apologize for the distortion from my microphone at times. That it's quite irritating. The nature of recording Zoom calls is that you can never fully guarantee the quality afterwards. I'm hoping that it's fairly sporadic through the conversation. I don't do a lot of talking, so it's okay. And it's only mildly distracting. But yeah, when I get excited, it gets a little bit like, Andy, calm down. Come on. I'm just going to let the conversation run. And I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back again afterwards just to tie things up and let you know how you can come along and get involved in more of those kinds of events in the future as well. Yeah, so I guess we'll make a start and kind of get into some of the questions that have come through. I've consolidated some of them as people sharing them when they registered, and thought there's a few themes that have come out. Just to say, I'm really thrilled to have Roxana Alexandru and Neil Hughes with me. It was, we had a bit of back and forth trying to get a date that would work for all of us. But it's one of those topics that I thought I would love both Neil and Rox to contribute, because they're both exploring and explored like inner critics and anxiety and social anxiety through a lens of humour in kind of different ways. And so it's felt like, something that I've been keen to get both of them in for. So Neil, we were just talking about when we first came across each other. And I mean, apparently Neil bought one of my albums in 2003, very randomly. I'm not sure how you came across it.
Just completely randomly. A friend I met in Manchester recommended this band, and it was, I think, a mail order thing. I think I had to email you and say I wanted one of your CDs, and you posted it over to me, and that was it until sort of 12 years later when we were interviewing each other about things.
Yeah, so that's really funny.
Very weird.
Yeah, and then so Neil wrote a book called Walking on Custard and the Meaning of Life, which is an absolute joy, and it was kind of there's this sort of ongoing dialogue through it with his inner critic that I just found a really endearing and insightful way of relating to that side of ourselves. And I was like, yes, I recognize that, and I know Neil's talked in other places as well about the power of just sharing those things that are going on within us, in terms of just being able to disarm and, yeah, and also connect with people. Because so often it's like, oh yeah, I have that thought too. And just knowing that is very helpful. And then Rocks, I met for the first time a few years ago. I think it was an online summit.
2019 or something,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, we were both involved.
A summit, INF summit, yes.
INF summit, that was the one, yes, yeah. Correct. And yep. So I've been following you ever since on social media, just very much enjoying the way that you play out that relationship that you have with your
social anxiety
yeah. and stuff, yeah. and yeah. some of the experiments and very playful approaches that you take to that, which I'm like, fair play, like I do not want to be doing that, but
I have embarrassed myself quite a few times on purpose, yes.
Yeah, so it'd be great to maybe hear about some of those things that you've done. And and I think, I mean, we're a small enough group if people want to kind of jump in and ask questions or make reflections or add comments or whatever, then please do, like, use the chat or raise your hand or whatever. Whatever's comfortable for you. And I guess, yeah, it'd be good to start maybe with some introductions to Neil and Rocks, and maybe you can tell us, like, yeah, like where, like what it is that you enjoy about exploring this topic of social anxiety, inner critics, that kind of thing, and maybe a little bit of basic background about the role of your sense of humor and how that relationship is built in you, in terms of the way that you use that with this stuff, and the way that you have used that through the years. So, yeah, I don't know who wants to start.
What a question. it's interesting. Enjoy is an interesting word, I think. Like, what do you enjoy about engaging with your inner critic? I don't know if it's something I would have done by choice, I think, if I hadn't been forced into it by my own life. You know, I think I'd sort of developed such a destructive relationship with my inner critic that I was forced into just dealing with it finally, and I completely reevaluating that relationship, and even recognizing it was a relationship and this inner critic was a thing that existed. I think for a long time I just saw myself as myself and hadn't realized I was spending so much time destructively criticizing myself until it became apparent to me, and then it was time to start, you know, changing that relationship. And I think humor was, I mean, again, it's one of those things that's sort of inseparable. Like, I probably wouldn't have seen it as something separate from myself, just like with the inner critic. So engaging with it with humor and finding ways to neutralizing it and laugh and being amused instead of being anxious and instead of beating myself up and ruminating and dwelling and all those things. So I think there was a point where I was actively trying to replace a lot of my thought processes with something funny, and I think that's partly where this kind of custard theme came from, where, you know, I just tried to find a slightly amusing angle on thinking about my anxiety that would at least cheer me up a little bit when I was experiencing it. So it was a way of reprogramming my brain, I guess. But yeah, it's interesting to think of it in terms of enjoyment. I like that framing.
Mm. Cool. Yeah, I think we'll get into the custard thing in a second. ask the same question to Rocks.
It's funny because I think I have on my profile now that I'm obsessed with social anxiety. So I have a very, interesting relationship with it, where I'm so much into this topic that it's all I want to talk about. And it started with phase one, where I was obsessed because it was so debilitating that I had to find ways to manage it, right? I couldn't go to work without feeling socially anxious. I couldn't go to interviews. I couldn't ask questions. It was just at so many levels of my life, it was interrupting it. So I just became obsessed with figuring out how to manage it. And then once I did, I just became obsessed with obviously helping other people managing it. And I love how Neil mentions, you know, the humor, because I think that's such a big component in managing it. It's one of the biggest ingredients that I like to tell people, is like, you need to have humor, because if you don't, you're going to fall prey to your inner critic, right? So you either can laugh at yourself or you can just berate yourself to no end and just make yourself feel worse. So through my experiments, which maybe we want to dig deeper, I found ways to appreciate social anxiety and how it put me into situations that made me uncomfortable and it made me embarrassed. But I was able to find a way to laugh at myself for that. And that gave me the power I needed to kind of manage my social anxiety, because that way I can push it to the side instead of letting it take hold of me, right? So humor allows for that to happen, to kind of just push it away. So I think it's super powerful to be able to laugh at yourself, to be okay with being embarrassed, misunderstood, whatever the case may be, instead of going down the dark route of I'm stupid, I'm incompetent, I don't know what I'm doing, right? So there's two paths. So I was trying to really lean towards laughing at myself and being okay with that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting hearing you say that, because I think what you've made me realize there is that for quite a long time, my goal has been not to engage with this stuff as much. I think that I kind of went through this terrible period of anxiety and then spent a long time reevaluating myself, rewriting this book, figuring out all this stuff, and retraining my brain with my inner critic. And the goal was always, I want to reach a day where I don't need to think about this as much, and it's not kind of something I'm consciously doing. And that kind of obsession was like, I was really relating to what you were saying. So I was like, yes, that feeling of obsession of, this is all I want to talk about, it's all I want to explore with people, right? Because I'm kind of going through that for myself. It's really interesting, like, that framing of it being this really important thing to engage with and actually enjoying the process of engaging with it.
Yeah, that's a super good point. Yeah, because the more you, so I went down the path of also avoiding it, and that was a disaster. It just enhanced everything. I'm sure you can relate to that. When you you try to avoid your anxiety, it just comes back and it's 10 times stronger than it normally is. So I was like, just, I'm going to lean into this. I'm going to go all in. I'm going to just challenge my social anxiety instead of avoiding it.
So Neil, would you say is that something that you have, like, the relationship has changed in terms of that obsession over time? And yeah, what's that look like?
I think definitely. And it's interesting kind of gearing into this, because so part of it is hard to tell apart from what's happening in my life now. You know, you have to re-engage with, and I'm in this kind of place where I'm trying to figure out what's next and what, you know, what my goals are and what is, you know, what am I even doing, which I guess is been a constant struggle. But it's definitely changed. I think back, like, so for me, the height of anxiety was probably 10, 11, 12 years ago. That was kind of the period where I would look at as the really anxious years. And then there was a few years where my focus was dealing with it. It was like, exactly like Rock said, I ran from it for years, didn't want to engage with it, and finally hit a point where, okay, no, this is so bad, I'm going to have to engage with it. And now I'm going to do nothing except engage with it. So I just spent years reading every book going and talking to people and trying out any kind of technique people said would work and going on weird retreat weekends and just trying to do anything that would help. And, you know, and it all added up. I learned a lot from that and was able to reevaluate the relationship. And I think, like, the goal after that was then to kind of integrate that into my life so I could live my life with this changed relationship with anxiety. Kind of, like, I think, you know, I talk a lot about in the book about the idea of being anxious, being like on this sea of custard. You know, you've not got this solid ground underneath you. You just kind of, you know, there's no foundation to build a life on. But the aim was always to get off that and to get to a solid ground where I could build a life with, which wasn't all about just my anxiety. It's about everything else. So yeah, it does feel like it's changed, but I'm not sure I've got enough hindsight yet to really give that whole journey in perspective. Maybe if you ask me in 10 years, I'll have like a very good answer.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, just to go back to the custard as the metaphor that you kind of built this whole your thing around, kind of root with the book and the TED Talk as well. What is it about custard that speaks to that experience of anxiety? As a substance.
You'd think I'd have a better answer to that. I think it's just the, it was this image of being stuck on it, of living on a ground made of custard instead of a ground made of ground. And it's, you know, with custard, you can do that. You can walk on it. It becomes temporarily solid. But it was the feeling that life underneath me was not wasn't solid. It was just temporary, and I had to kind of keep putting in this effort to remain afloat on it. And it, that was the feeling that went on for years until I began to drown in it. And that's when I started engaging. So this, the custard thing, like the physics of custard, had stuck with me since my physics degree at university. And I'd always thought about it for some reason. And it, somehow that image clicked in my mind, and that started turning into the book. So
yeah. I love it. I think it's fantastic. Yeah. And how long can you, how long would you be able to stand on custard before you'd start sinking?
Me personally?
One.
Again, you'd think I'd have tried it after all these years, but I think it's not long. I think you get seconds, but then you have to hit it again. So you just have to keep running on the spot, which obviously is something you can do for a while, but eventually you'll get tired. So the metaphor of that is, you know, if we can keep, we can keep on this kind of anxious life for a while, but eventually we'll run out of energy and we will sink. Mm-hmm. Unless we do something about it.
Yes. A great metaphor.
I like it. Love it. I like it.
Powerful. Yeah, so if we get into to like just looking at some of the areas that people have highlighted in their kind of registration questions, like one of the things that came up a few times was the idea of like being put on the spot. So social anxiety increasing when you need to maybe express yourself off the cuff, whether that's like small talk, public speaking, performing like at a bigger level, and mixing in with that, like a fear of being maybe misinterpreted or misunderstood can lead to over preparation, and just kind of getting caught in feedback loops of like, I need to be completely prepared. And then that throwing us off guard when, you know, you're in that social situation and something happens where it's like, I'm not prepared for this. So a couple of things in there. But I suppose, yeah, how do you intervene to prevent yourself from getting stuck in a feedback loop? To kind of draw both of those together. Have you got anything on that?
I do. The first thing that came to mind was, I always think be interested instead of trying to be interesting, because I think a lot of us go first internal. We start thinking, what can I say? What can I do? How can I make it funny? How can I make it interesting? And if you're blanking, just put it on that person. Just give yourself a moment to breathe. Ask questions, right? Not just any questions, right? Ask questions about something that they've said previously, so you can go back to a conversation that you had and keep that going. So that's a little tip that I usually do for myself. I can say, oh, hey, I remember you mentioned you went to that market a weekend ago or something. You know, so bring back something that happened so you can start re-engaging with this person. In terms of being misunderstood, I think that's one of the biggest fears that we have, because then if you feel like you're misunderstood, the first thing you do is you try to defend yourself. So, and you start over explaining and over talking, it just, things can really get out of control. And this is one of the things that I still struggle with, this being misunderstood. I feel like I'm being attacked and I need to do everything I can to be understood. My advice to myself is to sit with the misunderstanding. So be okay with people misunderstanding me, not getting the whole picture, and just being okay with that. And it's painful, but just sitting with that feeling, at some point you get more comfortable with it and you don't feel this need to constantly defend yourself, and you can just move on to the next part of the conversation. You don't always need to be understood, because again, everyone has different perspectives, different points of view. So no matter what you try, sometimes they will still not understand you. So just sitting with that uncomfortable feeling and just moving through it, I think, helps. It's something that I'm still working through. But that helps me from not getting stuck in that feedback loop of, what do I say now? How can I do this? That, and that's not a place you want to be in. So that's my quick tip.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is a brilliant question. I really empathize with it. I think, you know, as you were talking about it and asking the question, I was thinking of all these examples in my life when I've felt that need for control and the need for preparation. Like little things, like I remember learning to play music, learning to play piano when I was young, and I always felt like I could not understand people who could do it without the music. You know, I'm like, if you put the music in front of me, I'll be okay, but anyone who can play without it might as well be a wizard. And that's then how I felt about life afterwards. So there was that kind of desire for control and preparation and the script. Like knowing, so I started doing stand-up comedy, which you'd think is an awful thing to do for someone with anxiety and someone who needs to be prepared for every possible situation. And it really is. It was very anxiety-inducing. And particularly because my technique for it was to prepare for every eventuality. So I'd simulate the whole gig in my head. I'd be imagining what people would be saying. And I'm sure, you know, this is a healthy part of preparation as well. But I wanted that level of control so that I wouldn't be faced with not knowing what to do and with being blank. And that was kind of my big terror, is what if I have nothing to say? And then, you know, so I think it's really just something that completely has been like a theme of my life, I think. And I don't know if you've seen, did anyone here see The Rehearsal?
Yes.
HBO show. So there's this TV show, and I won't go on about it for you just because it's very annoying to go on about TV shows people haven't seen, but it's this thing called The Rehearsal. It's a comedy documentary about exactly this, about someone who's trying to rehearse their own life, and they rehearse every possible conversation and every possible outcome so that they can get it right in their actual real life. And I just, I loved it. I thought, I completely get it. I understand wanting to go to that level of complete control. And I think that the only way I've learned to deal with it is exactly as Rox was saying, it's like letting go of that need for control, letting go of the need of controlling other people's reactions that we can't, trusting myself and trusting my future self and saying, actually, I'll be okay with that. I don't need to prepare for this because my future self will handle that. And I started like a technique I found quite useful, which is a bit more practical than just saying let go and stop worrying about it, which is obviously quite difficult to do. But what I started doing was actively creating awkward moments on stage. So the beginning of my comedy sets were always just deliberately bad and awkward, which was surprisingly effective. I think it kind of helped with the audience because they saw that I was confident with it and I was doing it deliberately, and that kind of gave them a sense of confidence in me, like paradoxically. But it also just diluted the fear that my brain has about it, because I'm choosing to do it. I'm saying, look, it's okay, this moment of awkwardness is happening, I'm all right with it, and there's not actually a bad consequence. So it kind of broke that the sort of link between something going wrong and this imagined horrible consequence that my brain believed would be there. So I guess like leaning into the awkwardness, leaning into the situation we fear, and rediscovering that it's generally not that bad, or not as bad as I imagined. So that's
an interesting experience of it. Because with the element of control as well, you're almost sort of using that as a way to, okay, I'm going to set this up on my terms, and play with that idea of creating that awkward moment at the beginning, which you can't prepare for specifically, because it's like, I'm sure implicit in that awkwardness is uncertainty, but at least you're inviting it yourself on your terms rather than, yeah.
Yeah, it's a kind of paradoxical thing of uncertainty that I'm controlling. So still not really let go of my need for control, I guess.
But sort of working with yourself in that sense.
Yeah, it's using it in a more healthy way is how I would, if I was going to try and sell it, I'd say I'm using my need for control more healthily. And I don't know if there's a second stage beyond that that is actually just letting go of the need for control completely. But I'm not sure if I'll ever reach there or if I want to.
No, I think it's healthy. I think having a certain amount of control and wanting that, I think it's okay. And I see a lot of people talking, well, I have to always script my conversations, this is bad. And it's not really bad or good, right? It's just how you proceed with it, right? Scripting line by line, that's practically impossible to do. But coming up with predetermined topics that you potentially want to talk about and pull out of your hat, if you are blank, you're like, okay, well, at least I know, well, last month I went on vacation, my kid did this, whatever. So you have like four or five things that you have in the back of your mind to pull out if it comes to the moment where no one's saying anything. So in that way, you can have a little bit of control over it, but not to like scripting every word, you know? So that helps sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of takes me back to, I had a moment, the kind of mind blank moment that is still very vivid in my head, was when I was at university in a seminar, and I can't remember what the seminar was on. It would have been something about politics. And everybody was like having this conversation, contributing and saying all these very clever things and stuff. And then it came to me, I was put on the spot by the guy leading the seminar. He's like, what do you think? And I, my mind just went completely. And I don't, it's one of those, I don't know whether the mind is empty or full. It's like either way. And I think with that sort of overwhelming anxiety thing, it's like, it's full. It's like all of the thoughts are there all at once. And it's like white noise rather than just emptiness. But it was so embarrassing because I was like, I literally have no, I can't find a single word to use here other than.
And how did you get out of that one?
I just said, you're going to have to ask someone else. Like,
okay. And that's fair.
But it was like, I then lived with that. And it's like, I woke up in the night, like in cold sweat, like, oh, I can't believe it. And so the only way to then move through that was to talk about it and to laugh about it afterwards, really, with other people. Because it was like, yeah, just one of those moments.
That was like, and it's really situational, right? So I guess my technique or tip is more like with friends and if you're in a group, right? But yours is like you're put on the spot in like a big situation where, you know, all eyes are on you. That's totally different. So yes, you have to prepare for that in a different way.
And talking about a thing that you need some kind of anchor into
preparation.
I couldn't just be like preset talk, like what I did on holiday.
Right. No, that's not going to work in that situation. No one wants to know.
Well, make it quite interesting, but yeah.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Yeah. And yeah, maybe that because kind of the idea of overstimulation came up as well for people, and the, you know, the idea of external sensory noise. So like maybe you're in a busy environment or there's a lot going on around you, and then that translating to that inner noise that and you're in a situation where you need to be sociable or you need to function in some way. I wonder if you've got any thoughts around kind of managing that and keeping that clarity of mind in some way in those situations.
I think it's one of those areas where I don't think I understand myself as well as I'd like. Because if I put myself in those situations of being in a busy environment, being overstimulated, and I can quickly imagine some really good situations where I've been really happy and I've loved being in the crowd and it feels fantastic. And some of those are the noisiest, busiest, most socially, you know, busy moments. And then other times when I'm miserable and anxious and completely overstimulated, or even just a slight noise that's not welcome is enough to really trigger quite a lot of discomfort for me. So I feel very, and I'm not sure I've ever had a clear sense of what the pattern is. I think as I'm thinking about it now, it probably is again about control and choice and choosing to go to this particular crowd, choosing to be in this environment. If I'm going to a gig, a football match or a party, and you know, I sort of want to be there. Like, whereas the times when I haven't chosen it in the same way or something's happening unwelcomely, like there's suddenly a party in my house, and like it's like I really struggle with that. So for me, it comes down to a kind of comfort with the situation, and then that triggers the overstimulation, if that makes sense. But I don't know that I've got any wisdom on how to kind of translate one into the other. You know, I think like the amount of mental control required to embrace the situation I don't want to be in is something I'm probably not very good at. But it might be possible. Maybe I just don't try.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
I think, for a lot of people with social anxiety, they retreat inward and they just have this blank face and they're trying to handle it. And it comes off as rude, disconnected. And I've experienced that as well. And I'm an introvert, so for me, I get overstimulated really fast. Noise, having to speak over music, loud music. I don't do well in those types of environments at all. I prefer quiet one-to-one situations. So when I do find myself in an overstimulated, noisy environment, I let people know exactly how I feel, and it comes with practice. I literally say, I can't hear myself think right now. I'm going to just give myself 5 to 10 minutes to just be on my own. You know, I take a break and then I come back and I try to like recuperate. Sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't work. Obviously, you need to figure out again how to manage yourself, like you mentioned, Neil. It's hard depending on the situation. But being honest with the people around, and I know that's hard to do, but sometimes I just like to be vulnerable just for the heck of it and just let people know how I feel. And also just being comfortable being an observer. That's something that I had to really figure out for a long time, because I always felt like I have to say something. I have to be part of the conversation. If I'm not saying anything, they're going to think I'm boring. They're not going to want to invite me. So I always put so much pressure on myself and wanted to add to the noise instead of just stepping back and being okay, being an observer in some situations, right? And I think that's okay. You can just observe and just be there and not add to the overstimulation. But again, that comes with practice.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, as you said, sharing that, it's making me realize that this is, I can see actually some growth in myself on this, because there's lots of times I would make myself stay in situations of discomfort out of a kind of internal pressure, and the growth was to learn to remove myself from a situation where that overstimulation has happened, and for that to be okay. And I think the struggle then is the narrative I attach to it, because afterwards I then have a choice to attach different narratives, and I might attach the narrative of, man, I'm so boring, so lame, I can't believe I left that party, everyone's going to hate me. You know, you can imagine the narratives you can attach. And I can think of times I've tortured myself like that and times when I haven't. And it's, I think it's just been gradually learning to attach more favorable narratives. Like, actually, I know what I want. You know, I know that I didn't want to be in that situation. It's okay to not want to be in that situation. It's okay to have been uncomfortable and to have chosen to leave. These are all fine, but it can be difficult to always stick to that narrative. I think that I have found temptation to attach more negative narratives to things, and that's, I guess, where the whole inner critic comes in. Of, you know, there's always different ways of looking at any given situation, and the ones we choose is going to affect how we feel about them. So that's been a big part of the journey.
And in terms of those narratives, I'd be really interested to hear about the sound maybe of your inner critic or inner critics, how do you change that? Because obviously the negative narrative is going to kick in so much more loudly than, and it requires intervention really to, or maybe gradual habit changes to kind of shift into a more of a kind of a self-loving or whatever narrative. Any thoughts around what your inner critic sounds like, and how to gently nudge it, the voice of it?
You want to go ahead, Neil, or
sure? I can certainly try. I don't know if I've got a great answer, but I'll give it a go. I think part of me is fixating on the word sound, because they sound like me. They're just there's no, I think for a long time, I never made any kind of distinction between my inner critic and myself. It was just the sort of inner monologue, the inner experience would be negative. And I saw it as my thoughts. So I'm sitting there thinking these negative narratives about myself. And it would be really helpful if they had a more distinctive voice, you know, sort of maybe really high pitched or something, so I could like easily tell it when it's coming from a more negative point. But it's really just, it is the choice of narrative that defines whether or not it's my inner critic or me. You know, it's kind of a choice for me to create the inner critic by labeling these negative narratives as coming from them. You know, it's a kind of distancing maneuver so I can diffuse myself from the feeling that comes with it and not get so caught up in the narrative that I'm then spiraling and piling more pressure on myself. So the trick for me was learning just to distance myself from those thoughts and feelings at all, and to recognize the way they made me feel. So it's like I have this like a choice, right? I can find a perspective where I've got these two options in front of me. I can spend the rest of the night ruminating and dwelling on the fact I left the party, beating myself up, feeling miserable, hating myself, or I could just not do that. And recognizing which of those options makes me feel which way tells me which one is coming from the inner critic. It's kind of how's it feel rather than how it sounds, I think, is how I learn to distinguish what my inner critic is. And then my technique was just to try and find the absurdity of listening to them. It's like, why would I listen? Like, if I can choose between feeling this way or feeling another way, why would I ever choose the negative one?
I like that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's really good.
One thing came to my mind when you were talking, Neil. I used to think that I was my thoughts for the longest time. I was like this, I am my thoughts, you know, whatever I say, that must be true. So I really, like you mentioned, at some point, your internal monologue inside is like, you are your thoughts. You are what you say to yourself. And that gets hard, right? Because you start, there's so much weight and burden that you keep adding on top of yourself every single day. You know, you're incompetent, you're stupid, you're boring, and it just piles on. And disconnecting yourself from that is extremely difficult. The thing that worked for me was therapy. I'll be honest, I went to therapy for about a year to understand where my inner critic was coming from. And my therapist asked me many, many times, every time I said something that was even slightly negative, she would say, is that you talking or is that someone else? So is that thought yours, or did someone put that thought in when you were growing up, when you were a teenager, maybe somebody said something to you? So I had to challenge everything that came up. I was like, is that something that I'm telling myself, or did someone tell me that? And I started believing it. And the more I started doing this as an exercise, I realized that a lot of the stuff would just happened when I was a teenager, right, with my parents, things that they were telling me. I started embodying that and believing that as my own thoughts, right? And that's with many beliefs that we have, right, through life. That's why it's so hard to challenge your beliefs, because, you know, they're part of you. So really deconstructing and unlearning where these thoughts come from was the biggest game changer for me personally. So now when I have a negative thought, which is very rarely, honestly, because I have moved past that, I challenge it every single time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think 100% I've been through that whole process as well of like, what is me in all of this? You know, what is, if I'm not my thoughts, what am I? Because I'm not my thoughts. You know, it is definitely part of me. And learning to recognize when it's healthy to listen to certain thoughts and voices and feelings. Because, you know, I think a bad outcome of working through all this for me would be to just eliminate all negative emotion, right? Where I could just be in a room that's literally on fire and be like loving it and like I'm having a great time. You know, that's not, there's a certain amount of negative emotion that's required to healthily exist in the world. And I think that one of the other criteria I try to measure these things by is, so it's partly, is this my inner critic, is how it makes me feel, but also how in tune with reality is it? Is this actually a real thing that I'm criticizing myself for? Is there some validity to it? And is it, how much, is there maybe a little bit of validity that I could maybe have stayed in that uncomfortable situation for a bit longer? And, you know, or is there a lot of validity or is there no validity? Or, you know, it's trying to choose how much should I believe it? And it's quite difficult. I think the amount of analysis required to break down even one series of the one cycle of these thoughts is quite a lot, right? We don't have time to analyze every thought and feeling we ever have in our lives, because it takes longer to analyze than it does to have the thought or feeling in the first place, so we'd never catch up. So it's just about, I think, training ourselves to be better at recognizing it intuitively, so that, you know, the reality, I'm just slightly more in tune with reality when I'm analyzing my thoughts and feelings, and that the less of them are wildly out of perspective. Like, I'm not beating myself up massively for this little thing, but I'm also not letting myself off the hook if there is something that I should feel bad about, and trying to kind of find that where's reality in this, and train my brain to have these good heuristics. And I think it's difficult. I think it's a sort of lifelong process of growth of, you know, how much should I trust my own judgment and how can I improve my own judgment? Like, because you're using your own judgment to improve your judgment, which is difficult. I'm not sure if that made sense. It kind of made sense in my head.
That was really great. I really love that that idea of, you know, you have sort of so many of those thoughts to analyze that probably take many lifetimes to catch up with all of that. And actually, yeah, I mean, a lot of the time it is that sort of rumination and overthinking that can just then lead to those spirals as well of like, which thought is this? Where's this coming from? And you just like, oh, who cares? Like, let's just get on with what we're doing.
Yeah. And there's a contradiction inherent in it as well, which is that the whole point of me doing this is I don't want to ruminate and dwell on things anyway. That's the thing I'm trying to escape. So in order to escape it, I have to ruminate on the thoughts and figure out which, you know, I have to analyze my thoughts in order to stop ruminating. So there's a lot of traps involved in all of this. And it's just about taking enough steps back to analyze where we're at and how helpful is it being. And mm-hmm. over time, I think we get better at it through a process that is kind of difficult to articulate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's also looking at the patterns. If it's a recurring pattern, it's something that's holding you back. If you don't want to go and be social because you really think you're not interesting, you have nothing to say, and that keeps coming up, you really have to face that and understand, yes, where is this coming from and how can I manage this? Of course, we have like, 10,000 thoughts? What is it? 35,000 thoughts a day or decisions? I don't even, it's like, it's an insane amount of information that's coming at us. We can't analyze everything like you mentioned, Neil, that's just impossible. But if it's something that's recurring, it's really holding you back and you feel shitty about it and you just want to learn how to get past that, it does, I think it's worth taking some time to analyze a little bit deeper to move past it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. So imposter syndrome was something that came up for a few people as well. That kind of idea of, I suppose, the feeling of unworthiness of acceptance in certain environments or situations, kind of afraid that you're going to be found out as a fraud and ultimately, I suppose, rejected from the group. And then that sense that everything I've done up until this point is down to luck and, you know, no one's yet seen through my fraudulence, but it's only a matter of time. So, yeah, I wonder. Because I find imposter syndrome such a fascinating thing, and the way that it's talked about and like explored by people, you know, whether it's you need to overcome it or get rid of it. And like, I find that, like, I'm not sure that's the approach to take, because really it strikes me as containing something quite healthy, like we've been talking about already, like that sense of, I don't know, aliveness within a situation mm-hmm. and actually being somewhere. But yeah, I wonder, have you got any kind of, how do you tend to think about imposter syndrome? Is it something you experience? And do you have any kind of helpful ways to maybe manage those feelings if they come up?
Yeah, so I think statistically women experience it more, but men as well. So I don't know to what extent, obviously, but I feel it almost every single day when I show up on camera and I speak and I do my reels and my podcasts. I'm like, who am I to do this podcast? I don't know what I'm talking about. It's just, the list is just never ending, right? But something helped me kind of shift perspective on that was, one, my imposter syndrome has really helped me. It's benefited me. And it's you have to look at it, you know, obviously good and bad. But I've always pushed myself to know more, to be better. So that kind of ambitious nature coupled with imposter syndrome has really helped me get to where I am. So I kind of leaned into it. Okay, I feel like I shouldn't be here. Why? Okay, what else do I need to do? What else do I need to know? What kind of certifications? So on and so forth. And again, that can be very toxic because it's never ending, right? At some point, you're always going to feel like that and there's only so much you can do. So the other thing that really helps me is to remind myself that I cannot be an imposter in my own life, right? So I know what I know. I have the experience that I have. When I have more experience, then I'm going to know more, I'll do better. But at this moment in time, this is what I know. And I cannot be angry at myself for that. I don't know what I don't know. So in that sense, I cannot be an imposter in my own experience, if that makes sense. It's just, I am where I am right now. I can always get better, but I'm not going to discount where I'm at. So that kind of helps me put things into perspective.
That's good. I really like that. Yeah. Can't be an imposter in your own experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that too. I think that really struck me. I probably haven't experienced that much imposter syndrome recently until about 40 minutes ago when you were introducing me on this call and saying, you know, you're excited to have Neil here and he's written this book and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, I think in that exact moment, I really felt the imposter syndrome of, well, here it comes.
Oh, my plan worked. Good.
Yeah, definitely getting found out now. But it's interesting because I think, and I want to highlight it, like, because, you know, I'm aware that that's mostly an internal experience and probably doesn't come across or may not have come across. But a big part of, you know, as I was writing the book, a big part of the motivation for putting in the whole inequitic character and wanting to highlight the struggle with myself I was having as I wrote the book is because I was really sick of all these books that were written by people who sounded like they had it all together and, you know, you just have to be like them. And mm-hmm. I was like, actually, you can write a book about anxiety that's hopefully going to help people while having a horrible time and fighting yourself over the fact you're writing the book and how dare you. And, you know, I think highlighting now that I'm feeling imposter syndrome at the start of this call, I think is important because I think it's just a very normal reaction to being alive. You know, I don't think it's something that we can or should eliminate. It's kind of I think as Rock says, it's a positive driver, really. It's something that you can use as fuel to want to be a better version of ourselves. But for me, the trick is, again, it's about perspective. It's about reality. It's about just tuning into what's true in all of it. So there are things I'm objectively good at. And in those areas, I probably shouldn't feel too much imposter syndrome. I should feel confident and comfortable in doing them. And it's okay to believe that and to live in the confidence of it. And that's one way I struggle is sometimes not believing I'm good at things that I am. And then there's things I'm not good at. And that's also okay. And then I can kind of have a different kind of imposter syndrome where I try to live as if I am. And there's then a gap between what others expect from me or what I think others expect from me. And I'm living with that that deception of trying to keep up this mask of pretending to be good at something that I'm not. And I think that can be, you know, it could be something I'm saying something I'm good at, like it's a talent, which could be the case. But I think even just my experience of anxiety was for a long, long time, I refused to allow people to know. I had this mask up of not being anxious because it was part of my identity to be someone who had it all together. And it was important that people saw me that way. And that led to this imposter syndrome of I'm going to be found out. Someday they're going to find out that inside I'm falling apart and I can't actually, you know, I'm not as confident as I appear and I don't have it all together and I'm a massive fraud as a human. So it's not just imposter syndrome of I'm not good at this thing. It was, I'm just not good at being a person. And the sort of like the link between those two is they're both just different kinds of deception. You know, I'm deceiving myself into believing I'm not as good as I am, like, or I'm not as able as I am. And I'm not living in reality because actually I am good at this thing or I am good at being a person and I should accept that. Or I'm trying to deceive other people. Like, it's still not living in reality. So just trying to tune myself into what's real here and being confident in the things I'm confident in and being okay with the things I'm not and being open about, you know, in this moment, I'm anxious and I'm scared of, you know, talking to you guys about this stuff in case I get found out as a fraud. Like, that kind of allows me to live in reality, which takes away the power of the imposter syndrome.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. That's great. There's really some great stuff in what both of you said there. And like, I remember, because it was the call, I've talked about it a few times in the Haven and places, it was the INF summit where Rox and I met, where like I had really quite overwhelming imposter syndrome on that call and ended up just having to say it because it was like my head is so noisy here that I have to just say, look, first things first, I feel like a massive imposter and I feel like I haven't got anything to contribute that other people don't already know and all that sort of stuff. And then had several people send me messages afterwards saying, thank you so much for saying that. And it felt like everything relaxed, and whether that was just for them or whether there was something broader, I'm not sure, but it just felt like there was something shifted in that moment. And I felt, and I guess it's the sense of connection that we feel. When we're experiencing imposter syndrome, we might be projecting an ideal or a kind of idea of perfection onto somebody else and thinking they have it all together, like you're saying, Neil, with mm-hmm. other people who have written these books. And that's a projected thing that we have this belief that, oh, they are perfect, they are whole, they're complete, like there's nothing wrong in their life and I'm not that. And I know that I'm not that and I'm going to be found out. And so breaking that, and it's quite interesting because actually if somebody projects themselves as that, you're like, you are an imposter. Because you aren't like you are disconnecting yourself from the human experience and from that sense of belonging that we all have in the fact we are all messy and imperfect and just trying to figure things out and all of that sort of stuff. So yeah, the person who deliberately tries to deceive people as being the whole and the complete person who has all the answers is the imposter. Interestingly. Yeah.
Yeah, I did want to add something on luck, because that comes back a lot in relation to imposter syndrome. We just need to embrace luck. That's fine. It's a big factor of success for everybody. So it's okay. It's fine to just accept it and want more of it. don't feel bad that you feel like, oh, it was just luck. Well, it's fine. You know, it's if you look at all these, you know, these billionaires, you know, they definitely got lucky plenty of times. You know, you're not going to hear them complain about the luck that they got. So,
yeah, good addition. Realizing sort of time. I wanted to talk about appearances, because this was something that has been on my mind this year, because we did an inner critic. Tula took us through a photo yoga exercise looking at the inner critic a few months ago. And so it was kind of, embodying the voice of the inner critic in a photo. And part of that for me was like shaved myself down to a mustache, because my inner critic has a mustache. And then had the challenge of I was like, I'm not going to shave it off because I feel the inner critic's telling me to shave it off because it's embarrassing to have a mustache. So I was like, I'm going to challenge myself this week to go out and wear my mustache in public. And it was so uncomfortable. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this until it becomes less uncomfortable. And then I have the freedom to shave it off. But I think there was something about it, because it's like obviously a choice on your face. Like you've decided, like a beard, that's fine. It's just like, it's something I haven't done, which is shave. Like, that's not a choice. That's just, it could be laziness or whatever. But a mustache is that's a bold choice. Like you've said, right, I'm the sort of person that has a mustache. And that's what I realized was the part that I found kind of uncomfortable. And I know, Rox, you've done the sort of, the dopamine dressing practice came to mind.
About your mustache. What is your perception of people with mustaches? Because now you're projecting it on you. So I'm just kind of curious how you see people with mustaches.
Fierce and angry. Yeah, in my mind.
That's funny. Yeah. I have nothing against mustaches. You know, if that's the look, that's the look. I'll take it. You know, that's how you want to show up in the world. That's fine. But it's funny that you have this idea that there's something about mustaches that makes you uncomfortable to walk around
I think what I realized was it was less about the mustache and more about the wearing a choice that everybody can sort of see. Because I took a quote by, I don't know if you come across David Mitchell, comedian, The Peep Show, and he's on Would I Lie to You here. And one of the things he said on Would I Lie to You was, one of the codes I live my life by is that my appearance should be in no way noteworthy, but then again, not so unnoteworthy as to be in itself noteworthy, which I thought was fantastic. It's like, that summed up, you know, this idea of like, yeah, actually, the mustache was this representational, like a symbolic thing for me of, you know, people can see a choice that I've made. So actually I want to blend in, or like I want to be unremarkable and just sort of be left alone or whatever. And that's not necessarily what I actually want, if that makes sense. It's just, it's the inner critic, like play it small, blend in, don't show yourself too much in public and that kind of thing. So that dopamine dressing practice, can you remember that? Do you have anything to say about that?
So this is one of those core beliefs that I grew up with, because my parents used to make comments on my appearance and on other people's appearances all the time, and in a negative way. So if someone was wearing something too colorful or something too funky, they'd be like, look at this crazy person, just waving them off. And so I grew up with that. So I judged people a lot on what they wore and how they showed up. So I always war things for other people. It's for the perception of it. You know, I have to have the proper, you know, professional clothes. And again, once I started deconstructing, like, why do I think these things, you know? And then I see people on the street, like, wearing amazing things. And I'm like, oh my God, they look so happy. And they're wearing happy clothes and they feel so good in their bodies. I'm like, I want that. I want to experience that. But again, that comes at a cost if you have social anxiety, right? Because if you wear things that might make others stare at you and judge you, that's going to inhibit you. It's going to make you feel worse about yourself, right? So there's that tug and pull, right? Where you want to express yourself and do things that you like. But if you have social anxiety, that can really push you down, right? So again, starting slowly to wear first things that make you feel comfortable, right? Not that it has to be fashionable, but really be comfortable in your body. Because if you're not, then that's going to make it that much worse to potentially wear things down the line that make you happy. Because happy clothes, you know, people stare. So you have to find that confidence to be able to step out of your house and just be okay with that. People are just going to stare at you, but you love your clothes, right? You're not wearing clothes for anyone else. You're wearing them for you. So there's two sides to it, and you have to learn how to manage that and make sure that ultimately at the end of the day, you are okay with yourself and you're not doing it for someone else, which is something that I did my whole life. So that's the only thing I have to say about that.
Yeah, no, that's really great. And I think it's that embodying of the voices, as you said, your parents, like the judgment that then, and I think for me, that's probably something I've taken in from various places, is that sense of like, I've heard people judge very loudly about other people's appearances. So therefore, you know, if you do anything to express who you are physically in that sense, there are going to be people like, got a mustache, you know, whatever it is. Yeah.
I mean, probably not many.
No, well, that's the thing. And like, I, you know, look at people with radical facial hair, I'm like, cool, fair play. Yeah,
that's the other thing. They could be staring at you because they're jealous and like, oh my gosh, I want to have that mustache, or I want to have, you know, that piece of clothing. You know, I would never dare do that, but I'm going to stare at you because it's so cool and so awesome and I'm jealous of you, right? So you don't know why people are staring at you. It could really be for a good cause, but you don't feel that.
There's that reframe, sort of walking around. I know what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Cool, huh?
Right. Right,
yeah. Has anybody got anything that they want to maybe pick up on, or say, reflect back, or anything like that, before we have a final question? I've got a final question that I think that came through that was, this probably quite a helpful way to end. Jump into, if you want to use the chat or anything, then do. The question was like, how do you think about goals or intentions in this area, and how do you measure progress and growth in a kind of meaningful way? And Neil spoke earlier about like having, I've just realized that's an area of growth for me. I've, you know, noticed that maybe even in this conversation. But yeah, I wonder if have you got any ways of tracking progress in these things?
I don't know that I do have anything concrete. I'm kind of, it's interesting you ask me now, because I'm currently in a process of reevaluating my entire life and existence. So my partner's away for a couple of weeks, and a few days ago, and on a bit of a whim, I opened an old box and went through and I found my old diaries, and I've started reading through all my diaries from when I was about 14 until about 25 is as far as I've got. And it's been astonishing to me to see like some things that are like contextualized that, and that I thought I had clear memories of, or I thought I had a particular narrative about, and I'm reading what I thought at the time, and it's completely changed my perspective of who I was at the time. Because so I think if you'd asked me last week, I'd say I'd probably not, I would say I've grown, but I wouldn't be able to put any finger on any particular thing. And now reading this, I'm thinking, oh no, I can see the growth. I can see change. I can see there's no way I would act like that now, or have said that, or would have done this, or, and it's not something I can kind of, I don't have a good measurement for it. I think it's it's one of those things that's impossible to quantify, really. And the question I've got at the moment, because your first part of the question was about goals, is I don't know what my goals are right now. I think for a while, my goal was deal with this anxiety. And then my goal was fill up my life with some things that I like. And now I've kind of done both of those. And I'm like, well, what's next? I'm busy. Life's okay. I'm not as anxious anymore. But what now? Like, do I have goals? Do I want goals? Is that a problem? Or is this contentment? Like, should I be worried about that? So I'm kind of in this...
New anxiety cycle.
Yeah. So I'm kind of... I'm in this evaluation position right now, and I don't know that I've got a good answer about what I should do. But I think that the only thing my experience tells me is that consciously engaging with it in some way is more important than how I consciously engage or what I'm trying to get out of it. It's just the fact that I'm consciously engaging, I trust, will take me to somewhere useful and help me figure out answers to those questions, or just to stop asking them if they're not that important.
So I'll speak in terms of like social anxiety, because that's kind of like my area, my niche area. I still keep actually a social anxiety list. So it's a huge list of all the things that I wasn't able to do because of social anxiety. And I keep adding to it, right? So things that I've never done or that I would like to do, but social anxiety kind of keeps me back, like doing an improv class, for example. You know, Neil, you mentioned that. Karaoke. Going up to a TED talk speaker and asking questions, right? So I keep a list of things that I just still cannot bring myself to do. So that's kind of like how I measure my progress throughout years. And another practical way that I do this is by looking back at 10 years ago when I started with my social anxiety journey to understand, okay, well, I couldn't ask a question in a meeting. Where am I at now? I can literally just interrupt anybody. Not that it's a good thing, but I'm comfortable enough to do that. So I can measure, you know, okay, just I was a mouse in a corner and now I can be aggressive, you know, so it's you know, from one end to the other. And I ask myself this all the time, like, what was I not able to do 10 years ago, 5 years ago, last year that I can do now? And what are the things that I still cannot do that I would love to do 5 years down the line? So in that sense, I kind of think, what should I do next that's uncomfortable, right? So that's kind of how I measure my milestones. You know, so I speak a lot about social anxiety, but I have a hard time speaking out about anything else, right? My opinions, social issues, politics, whatever the case may be. So I've never been able to do that. So I recently started opening up that possibility, right? So I opened a new social account just for that, to practice that area. And I'm extremely uncomfortable, right? Because a lot comes with opening up those conversations. So I'm always kind of trying to think what is next in terms of making myself uncomfortable.
That's great. Yeah.
I wrote all those questions down. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. And that sort of gives you that perspective of what's next and what's like just up there, as opposed to what's all the way down there that I'm nowhere near. And then I kind of beat myself up because I'm not near.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not ready. And it's okay if you're not ready. You don't have to have the next thing, you know, it will come. Right.
Yeah. Fantastic. I mean, we could talk about, there's so many more areas that we could go, and as always, these things just zoom by. But I really, really appreciate both Neil and Rox and all of you for being here. This has been great, and I'll share the replay and keep in touch. If there's anything that comes up for you afterwards, do email and I'll kind of pass things on. And just put that out to Rox, where's the best place for people to connect with you, and if they want to kind of
rox@honestrox.com, that's my email, or honestrox.com, you can find all my resources there for social anxiety.
Fantastic. And the same to you, Neil.
Best place is walkingoncustard.com, or neil@walkingoncustard.com.
Which has a great spinning Neil head on it that I tried screen grabbing.
Spinning Neil. Oh, it spins when you hover it. Were you trying to download the image that I made spin just to be annoying? Yeah. I'm sorry. Could have emailed me.
I'm having regrets now.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Andy, for inviting us as well. I really enjoyed this. Absolutely. I appreciate you putting it on. It's been really good.
Pleasure. Oh, it's been so good. Yeah.
This was really wonderful. Thank you.
See you all soon.
Love to see you.
Bye,
everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So what did you think of that conversation? I would absolutely love to hear from you if anything resonated, which I'm sure it must have done. We've also got a forum discussion dedicated to this topic in The Haven. So if you'd like to explore more around this alongside other like-spirited folks around the world in a safe and private space, then yeah, come and join us there. Hopefully this conversation gave you a bit of a flavor of how Haven conversations sound and feel and look. It was one of our courtyard happenings, which is they're the events where I open it up to the public to kind of register and join us, and I invite people from outside the community to come and share an area of expertise, share their wisdom, have a conversation with me. There's a workshop element sometimes as well, if there's a practical aspect to what they do. I'm aiming to bring more of them into, or bring a consistency to the courtyard happening. So my aim is to do it once a month, and there might be might be more than that this year. So come and check out what's going on in The Haven. Go to the-haven.co. We also have our Cotter happenings, which are we have two core ones each month at the moment. And they're open community conversations. So we kind of, the members of the Haven itself, we just have a conversation around different questions. We might look at parts of a book or a video or an essay or a blog post, and topics that people have indicated that they'd like to explore, that kind of thing. We just have an informal chat about it, and it's always a great time to connect with one another and to learn and to hear different perspectives and experiences and that kind of thing. So you can come along, you can be involved in the discussion if you want, or you can just sit back and observe and listen and get to know what's going on for people. So I'd love to invite you to come and check out the membership, as I say, the-haven.co, or find the link in the show notes to learn more. I'd love to welcome you in and get to know you inside the community. All right, well, that will do us for this week. Have a great week. Until next time, do remember that you are an artist. The world needs your art. Now go and make somebody's day. Bye-bye. Thank you.